In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
How can you tell when you give a great pro-America speech? When the hate-anything-American crowd on the left hates the speech. There's a lot of divisiveness here in America now, and although many on the left accuse Trump of being divisive, it's actually the ones doing the accusing that are dividing America. Obama, Hillary, pretty much the entire Democrat Party machine, pundits on Fox News, National Review, RedState.com, and groups like Black Lives Matter. But I think we're on the threshold of a reuniting of America. Trump gave one of the best speeches I've heard in years. He recognized that people and America are down, but he makes you want to dream again and do big things again, because you know he's done it. Politicians like Hillary can only talk about it. And so listening to Trump, you just start feeling good about America again. That's so different than the last 8 years of Obama making you feel bad about being an American, of everyday people being blamed, of watching America get torn down, not by its enemies, but by our own leaders. There are better times coming. There is no place in America where this divisiveness is more true than the black communities, where liberal policies and ideology has destroyed black lives for decades. In fact, you could say that the liberal policies that have destroyed black America for the last 8 years have been leaching out into the larger American society, tearing us apart, making us feel bad for who we are, and constantly looking for someone else to blame. Our next guest knows all about that, and then we'll talk with Brendan Kirby, who's been at the RNC convention all week, and we'll get his boots-on-the-ground look at how the party really is starting to show signs of unity. I'd like to welcome Burgess Owens. If you're a football fan, you probably recognize his name. He is a former Super Bowl champ with the Oakland Raiders, and before that, he had a standout career with the New York Jets. But he has a new book out that we want to talk to him about, Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. Burgess, it's an honor to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Mark, thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts. A very topical issue and something I think will help to bring our country back once we realize, you know, where our foundation should be.
Yeah, and that's really what I like so much about your book here, is it really seeks to unite people and also to really wake up the black community as to how they're being sabotaged by some of these organizations that are supposedly out there to support them. Before we get there, though, talk to us a little bit about your upbringing in the South, what your household and family was like, and so forth.
I'm so glad you're asking that as a start, as a backdrop, because people need to understand why I feel insulted when people say they want to apologize for my race, because we have nothing to apologize for. Our race, the black race, from 1865 to 1965, we're one of the most competitive, Christian-based, successful, mediocre-rising middle class than any other race in our nation. At that time, and this was, again, I grew up in segregated South of Tallahassee, Florida, over 50% of black Americans nationwide were part of the middle class. We had the highest percentage of entrepreneurs in our country, the highest percentage of men committed to marriage and their kids in the country. We were very competitive in terms of our black entrepreneurs, so competitive, matter of fact, that the Democrats in 1932 had to pass a law, which is still in the books today, which protects the white unions against black entrepreneurs. That was the backdrop of a community that came out of that allowed me to leave there to go to the University of Miami so assured that I was going to succeed in anything I did. And our nation, both blacks and whites, needs to relearn our history, to recognize that we are the country that, by choices, we can do anything we want to, and as long as we understand and be proud of who we are in our history.
And as you go around and speak to groups and especially to black groups, do you find that a lot of them are just shocked to hear a lot of what you say, especially in terms of some of these organizations that we'll get to in a minute and how they've really undermined the black communities?
Yeah, it's a surprise because, keep in mind, and I'm going to talk about the betrayal of our race in a minute. One of the founders of the NAACP was John Dewey. John Dewey was a communist, a Marxist, atheist, the founder of ACLU, which is an anti-Christian ACLU. He's also the founder of the Progressive Educational System, which on purpose neglects the history of our nation. So yes, not only a black American surprised, every American surprised at not only the success of our country, of our community, but how it was subverted by the NAACP. Let me just do this real quickly, give you an idea. I just mentioned how great we were doing up to 65. Here we are today. This is the result of betrayal of the liberal agenda, and I call it the royalty black class elitists. Those are black Americans who are also socialists and have also done damage to our race. Today, we have 83% of black male teen males, 83% across our country that are unemployed. If you go to Chicago, 93%, 93 out of 100 black teenagers are unemployed and soon become unemployable. You have 70% of black males, liberals, that have been taught it's okay to abandon their children and their family for sake of marriage. We have 40% of black males dropping out of high school and then another 40% dropping out of college. So you see, we have in place a petri dish of disappointment, of low expectations, of failure, and it all began in 1910 with the NAACP. It was not begun by black Americans. It was begun by 21 wealthy, white, socialist, Marxist, atheist, race-controlled Democrats, the antithesis of the Martin Luther King Sr.'s community of Christians, capitalists, entrepreneurs, and folks of really competitive independence. That bit of stealth, that's the only way they could have gotten into my community. That bit of stealth has been going on today, all the way up today, what's called BET. BET is Black Entertainment Television. It is not a black organization. It has not been for 15 years. It's owned by white, wealthy liberals, the Redstones in Viacom. And ever since they bought the BET back in 2001, they have firehosed my community with anti-white, anti-police, anti-American, anti-woman, anti-family, liberal filth. So if you wonder why we now have Black Lives Matter, it is not organic. It's been manufactured, it's been promoted for years to get the black vote. What Democrats do very well, and they have since 1910, is they do very well on breeding black Democratic voters. Mm-hmm. And so we need to put an end to that by exposing the wizard behind the Wizard of Oz and getting our country again, be excited about who we are and our basic foundation and the principles we're founded on.
You know, after reading that portions of your book there that talk about the NAACP and their Marxist founders, I have to say I was totally floored by that. I really had no clue. And so I went out and did a little digging, and sure enough, was able to confirm every bit about that, that the founders, every single one of them, they were either Marxists themselves or had ties to communism. I just had no clue about that. But what's their goal, though? I mean, was it to use blacks to bring down America by using them as kind of a wedge to be divisive in society? Or, and also, you had a lot of early Marxists that were very racist. I mean, was it maybe instead a goal to repress blacks? So what are your thoughts on all that?
It is, you have to understand, there's a certain heart, and this is sometimes difficult for Americans to understand, because we've been trained and taught, particularly the last decade, to see each other from inside out. So it's sometimes tough for us to recognize there are people who actually have the kind of heart that we've seen in the Democratic Party. The goal basically is very simple, and it was stated best by the Democratic Margaret Sanger, the evil abortionist, who called our race reckless breeders. Mm. What they have decided to do, very simply, they look at our race as a way to get to their end game. Socialism and atheism is not about race, it's about class. It's elitism. It's those who feel they're better. And in my book, I talk about the evolution and eugenics and where that came from. But at the end of the day, there are people who actually believe basically they are genetically and created better than the rest of us. So the Democrats have done a couple things. They, first of all, have been breeding out daughters for the profit-making abortion cartel. There's over 1,800 black babies killed every single day by white abortions, and we don't hear about that because, again, the Black Lives Matter don't really matter when it comes to our babies. 80% of those abortion clinics are placed in black neighborhoods. That's called breeding. Then you look at what they've done. The NAACP used the medium called The Crisis. That was a magazine, because once the blacks trusted the NAACP, they trusted the messenger, which is through The Crisis. Today's messenger is BET. And the information is going through that, the brainwashing of 15 years of anti-police, anti-American, and anti-white, is finally showing up on the streets of our country. Is their get out the vote and realize this. Now understand that every time we come up with a major election is when they come up with issues like this, because they're trying to rev up the young people who are normally not engaged, normally not educated, rev them up with anger. So all they'll do is come out and vote, and then they'll go back and they forget them until next election time. That is the heart of the Democratic Party. And once we understand that, we're going to get this thing back. We're going to realize that our enemy is not each other. It's not blacks and whites. It's ideology. It's atheism.
That's right.
Socialism and liberalism.
That's right. Okay, we are up against the clock. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Burgess Owen. He is the author of Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Burgess Owen. He's a football star with the Jets and a Super Bowl champ with the Raiders. We're talking to him about his book, Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. It's an in-depth look at how socialism and liberalism has infiltrated the black community in America and the tremendous damage it has done. And so, you know, going into the break there, you're talking about some of this damage and how these Democrats are essentially using the black community. You've got solutions, though. So let's make sure that we talk about those.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And solutions I'm very excited about, because things we can do. The first one is that we understand now there's a wizard behind the curtains. Let's, as a country, bring that wizard out and have him explain themselves. We need to invite Phil Dahlman, Sherry Redstone, the board of directors of ICOM, those who put in place a strategy 15 years ago to get us to where we are today, where we're totally racially divided, for their political gain. So let's have them explain that to us, explain Black Lives Matter. Instead of us bantering back and forth, we should have those who have a real investment into this to do that. The other part, which I'm very excited about, is that we have 28% of black Americans who hold the same conservative values that I do. God, country, we believe in our race, we believe in freedom, we're excited about a future for our kids. And if those 28% begin to understand that our power lies in being political free agents. And political free agency says this: if we are capitalists, the last thing we do as a capitalist is vote for a socialist. If you're a Christian, truly Christian, not just for the show, we do not vote for atheists. It doesn't happen. And if you really are into educating our poor black kids, then it's time for us to stop voting for those who don't believe in educating our poor black kids. And last but not least, if we believe in the sanctity of life, the Democrats that are Margaret Sanger, black kids are weeds. We need to put them out of office and not vote for them. This is what happens when you have 28% of black Americans, or any portion of that, that believes in and votes as a political free agent. All of a sudden, the Democrats cannot depend on the 90% of black Americans pulling the lever just because they're Democrats. If we can pull back, it not only changes the political landscape, but allows us to be empowered to have the Democrats work for our vote, the Republicans work for our vote, and if we hold true to the values that we believe in, we'll not only pull back our race, our community, from the abyss of socialism, but I truly believe this, Mark. I believe that small minority of black Americans whose ancestors were once slaves in this country could be the same saviors for our nation to bring us back from the abyss of socialism. That a handful of a minority of black Americans who believe the way we do changes the entire landscape, and I look forward to being part of that process. The other thing that we need to do is there is a group, and I list them in them, and I talk about in my book, called the Royalty Black Class Politicians. These guys have voted for every anti-black policy that's been on the books. And you remember, Mark, guys like Joe Namath and Jim Plunkett, guys I played with, great players. But guess what happens when he got old and couldn't play and couldn't produce? We all retired. Well, these guys, the John Lewis, the Elijah Cummings, the Black Caucus, all those elitist black politicians who've done nothing for our race need to en masse resign today. They need to give it up. They're proven they are totally inept. And it's time for us to get new blood, people who believe more in our race than their liberal causes or their class. If we do that, black Americans will really begin to understand and be able to experience the American way that has been available for us all these years.
Well, and hats off to you for that. But as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking this is a steep uphill climb you've got going here, because you're essentially fighting against a lifelong programming by those on the left that have infiltrated the black communities and told them that the government handouts that people like Elijah Cummings and stuff are there to give out, that's your way forward. So how do you get past that? How do you get past that lifelong indoctrination?
And that's a very, very good question, because when you take it off in bites, you realize it's really not that hard of a fight after all. Mm. Keep in mind what I just mentioned. 28% of black Americans believe exactly the way I do. What the problems of the Democrats, what they've gotten themselves in trouble, is they now depend on 90% of us to vote for them, and they've taken us for granted. So it won't take very much to peel off 10, 15, 20% of black Americans who believe the way I do, and to finally recognize. That's why it's really important that we have the Phil Dahlmans, the Cherry Redstones, and the board of directors. We need to expose these guys, to put them out front and ask them these questions about Black Lives Matter. Because once Americans see that, this is what I've always appreciated about this country, about our ancestors. We will fight if we know we're in a fight, and we will win. The problem we've had up to this point, and we start off talking about the NAACP, we didn't know we were in a fight. We thought we had friends and these advocates, to find out that they are nothing but enemies to us, and they're backstabbers, intergenerational backstabbers. So once we understand we're in a fight, the 28% of black Americans, there's a bunch of us out there, we just have to be educated. We will begin the process, and then once we start that, the rest of America will see how it's done, and we'll win this thing.
Yeah, and I think that's really the key point, too, that needs to be driven home, is that under a situation like socialism, which is so many on the left are pushing, someone else is owning you. And socialism really is the new form of slavery.
And it's interesting, because the Democrats have always been the ones that have, as a party, and I talk about this, they've been the party that has always looked down on the black race, used the black race, and tried to enslave the black race. The very worst form of slavery is not physical slavery. With physical slavery, as long as you have a spirit of freedom and a mental attitude of freedom, you'll find a way to escape.
Yes.
You will not allow them to take over. Mental slavery, spiritual slavery, is the worst of all kind, because they give up even the idea of escape. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of black Americans are today. Those who walk in the streets of Black Lives Matter have no hope in this country, because they've been trained all their lives not to.
Yes.
And I realize that we can't get everybody back right now. But let me just say this real quick. I know you're going to a break pretty soon. It was 30% of Americans who were patriots. Only 30%. Another 30% were Tories, and the rest of them were just not involved. That same 30% that got our country to where it is, the War of Independence, that 30% can be now translated to 30% of black Americans who do the same,
yes.
get our independence in this process.
Yes, absolutely. God bless you for what you're trying to do, and wishing you all the best success. Again, it's Burgess Owens in his book, Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps, and we'll make sure that we put that up on iSpyRadio.com. Burgess, thank you so much for your time.
Mark, thank you. It's a team effort. Thanks for the efforts, and let me get the message out there. Appreciate it. Big time.
All right, great. Thank you. Up next, Brendan Kirby and the RNC Convention. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're going to shift gears now to the RNC convention that just wrapped up in Cleveland. And I'd like to welcome Brendan Kirby. He's a senior political reporter for LifeSat, who's been there all week covering the convention. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be on with you.
You know, going into the convention, people were worried that it might be boring, but holy cow, starting even the week before, it was exciting with the drama around the Rules Committee. So what were your impressions looking back now? Did you think it was boring?
Well, first of all, I think Donald Trump is never boring. So whether you like Donald Trump or don't like him, I think we can safely say that if he's elected, he will not have a boring administration. So it was pretty exciting,
no.
And it was a little more newsy than these conventions typically are, because they're such stage-managed affairs usually, and this one went off script a little bit at times. And
yes,
that's just sort of Trump. The drama follows him.
Well, and it's refreshing in a way. So much of politics right now seems scripted. I don't think Hillary says anything without first running it by some sort of focus group. And it was actually refreshing to see both the good and the bad during the convention. I mean, you had that freedom, it felt like, to be able to say what you really felt. And I found that very refreshing.
Well, I think more than anything, that is the quality that really endears Trump to his supporters.
Yes.
They see him as genuine. And I think it allows him to get away with some of the flip-flops that he's had over the years. And, all through the Republican primaries, you remember his opponents tried to sink him by pointing out, hey, you said something different about this issue a month ago or 3 years ago. And I don't think that stuck because people saw the way Trump talks and interacts with people, and it reminded them more of how they talk and interact with people. He talks about politics the way normal people talk about politics,
yes,
rather than the way politicians do. And I think that is, it turns people off, obviously, too. But I think that maybe more than anything else is why he became so popular in the Republican primary, because people saw it. They see it as genuine. A lot of it is, his willingness not to be politically correct. But it's even beyond that. It's just he talks like a regular guy.
Yeah, he does. And I think that is a little offsetting to some people, too, as you say, just because so many times when you hear a politician speak, they've kind of tested the waters with what it is that they're going to say. They've really thought about it. And I think with Trump, he's kind of a stream of consciousness where, he may not have really necessarily narrowed down the exact right way that he wants to say something. And I find that refreshing.
And it's certainly not poll tested, as you mentioned.
Yes.
In a modern presidential campaign, speeches and really everything the candidate says goes through so many layers and fact checking, and they run speeches through software programs designed to detect signs of plagiarism, which obviously came back to bite the Trump campaign this week. And he doesn't have any of that infrastructure, for good or bad. Even if he wanted to, he doesn't have all these layers of consultants and pollsters and people that could do that. So, it's pretty much just the Trump show.
Well, and I think that's good because, a lot of times, having been in, around the world of statistics and polling, a lot of times you get sort of tunnel vision on those things where you kind of narrow it down to this is sort of the core message that we want to get out of this. And the problem, though, becomes is that there's a lot of messaging that you simply leave by the wayside that ought to be talked about. And I think he really has broadened the field a lot and broadened the discussion.
Yeah, I think that's true. And as you pointed out, the danger is that you can get knocked off message. And we've seen that throughout the campaign. And we saw it a little bit this week. Obviously, the Trump campaign did not want to spend the first day and a half talking about the Melania Trump speech, the way it was talked about with the similar language of Michelle Obama's speech. So, that wasn't good for him. The Ted Cruz thing obviously was not really what they wanted to be talking about. So, it's with Trump, you sort of take the good and the bad. You get sort of a more genuine sounding person that doesn't sound poll tested, but you also get a campaign that's prone to mistakes. So we'll see how that shakes out.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting as well in the sense that you get both the good and the bad. And I think in a way that really humanizes him and humanizes the whole campaign, because when you are so scripted, you don't come across as human. And I think the way that he is going about it, I think it makes him much more relatable. I think it makes him much more genuine. And I think we're seeing a different kind of Republican coming out of this convention. In the past, the Romney type conventions, oh my goodness, he wanted total control out of everything that came out of that convention, out of what everybody was going to say. It was very domineering and controlling. And with Trump, at least you have that freedom to say what it is that you really want to say, including people like Cruz.
Right. I mean, Ted Cruz's speech surprised a lot of people, and maybe was even more surprising was when we learned that, he wasn't pulling a fast one. The Trump people saw the speech before he gave it and said, go ahead and give it anyway.
Yeah. Well, I have an article up on LifeSet about that very thing. I think it actually shows, in my mind, the real brilliance of somebody that allows, and also his leadership qualities, in the sense that you allow somebody to say what it is they want to say and then realize that people are always going to have to make a choice on that. Do you want somebody that on Trump's side that is very pro-American, and then Cruz who says, "Well, it has to be my way or no way at all"?
Right, exactly. And as you mentioned, not just Mitt Romney, but almost every modern convention has tried to control every detail down to what every last speaker was saying. And you do get a more freewheeling convention when you just don't really do that. And again, as we said, that's the good and the bad. You get But I think it also benefits Trump. I mean, this is sort of how he stayed in the news too, because things are so unpredictable.
Yeah, you just don't know what he's going to say. And in my mind, I think that not only makes it more free, I think it makes it more honest as well. We are up against the break here. Everyone stay with us. We're going to be having lots more with Brendan Kirby, political editor for LifeSet. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, and we're talking with Brendan Kirby. He's a senior political reporter for LifeSet. He's been covering the RNC convention in Cleveland all week and really getting his boots-on-the-ground perspective of everything. And, you know, speaking of boots, one of the things that we were told leading up to the convention was that there's going to be about 30,000 protesters, and this is a major concern since there's only going to be about 5,000 cops on hand. But the protesters never really showed up in mass like that. So what did you hear about that? Why didn't they materialize?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to kind of tell how many there were because the site was so big and they had everything kind of fenced off and you'd have to go through different roadblocks. You needed like three different levels of security badges to be able to get into the arena, which we found out about. But, you know, we had to go get more credentials. So there were a lot kind of around the area and it was largely peaceful and the security was great. The Cleveland police were all over the place. He did have an incident a couple days ago where some communist activists tried to burn a flag. And,
yeah, that was something.
The police arrested him.
Set himself on fire there.
Right, not charged with the flag burning, but with kind of related offenses because the Supreme Court has said that flag burning is constitutional. But, you know, they were arrested and they gave a press conference outside of the Cleveland courthouse. And he had some other instances, but mainly they were peaceful. There was a lot of talk about, you know, the new Black Panthers were going to test Ohio's open carry gun laws and maybe cause problems, and that wasn't the case. I saw Cornel West, the Princeton Black intellectual activist. He was out there speaking under a sign that said America was never great, which that was kind of funny because someone should, from the Hillary Clinton campaign, should get in contact with them because that undercuts their narrative that America is and always was great. It kind of mixed messages there.
Yeah. I'm glad they didn't show up. I thought that would have been a distraction. But it's interesting that leading up to the convention, so many were anticipated to being there, and it just a total fizzle. So. Let's start about talk about some of the drama there within the convention itself, some of the tension there. The week before the convention, you had the Rules Committee over voting your conscience and freeing the delegates and so on and so forth. And the anti-Trump people failed pretty badly in the Rules Committee. They got less than half. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this was the last gasp of the Never Trump movement. And I always thought that this was kind of a quixotic enterprise on their part at this point that they were going to be able to push this through, but they tried to get the rules changed to what they wanted was a conscience clause where delegates could ignore the results of the primaries and vote however they wanted to. And so the Trump campaign and the RNC put together a rules package, and this is the first attempt was to try to defeat that, and they were not able to do that, and they got some petition together for their rule changes. They weren't able to do that. And, you know, there were some sore feelings. There were some people who were upset about that. You know, there were accusations of, you know, Gestapo tactics on the RNC's part for, not following the rules, not giving them a fair chance to present their case. But in the end, you know, I mean, the delegates didn't really seemed to be in the mood to tear their convention apart over this. We caught up with Ken Cuccinelli, the former attorney general from Virginia, and he's been one of the big conservative leaders in the country and was a big Ted Cruz supporter and was he, along with Senator Mike Lee, were really trying to push this. And cameras actually caught him taking his credentials off and throwing them down in protest at the vote. But we caught up with him the next day, and he was pretty plain. He said, "I'm voting for Trump. There was never a chance that he was not going to vote for Trump if he was the nominee." And he actually made the case that the people, the media and others had misunderstood what they were trying to accomplish. He said it wasn't an anti-Trump vote. It was a Trump to empower the delegates and was really a fight against the establishment. And he made the point that if the Trump supporters realized that that's what they were trying to do. You know, they were trying to attack the same rigged system that Trump complained about during the campaign. Maybe they would have even joined him. But nonetheless, he said that he had no interest in carrying on any kind of subterfuge for the rest of the convention. I talked to a delegate from Florida who originally backed Jeb Bush, and you don't get more establishment than Jeb Bush. And, you know, he said, just basically, enough of this nonsense. We have our nominee. We have to rally around him. So the delegates were pretty unified, I think, even if there are some holdouts among some Republican elected leaders.
Hmm. Well, I have so much mixed feelings about this whole free the delegates thing. To me, when you're elected as a delegate to reflect the will of the voters, then you're not there to vote your conscience. You're there to represent the will of the voters that put you there. And so anyway, I think that debate is going to continue for the next 4 years. But let's go ahead
and particularly at the last minute. I mean, and this is an important point, because it'd be one thing if the Republican Party decided, hey, we're going to set up a system where people elect smart, politically connected delegates and then put the judgment in their hands to pick our best nominee. You know, I think people would see that as fair and above board from the beginning.
Yeah.
But it would be kind of weird to say, well, we're going to have this whole primary system, and whoever wins these primaries wins these delegates, and that's how you win the nomination. And then, a week before the convention, say, no, that's not, we were just kidding about all that. Really, we're just going to let the delegates decide. I mean, people would have seen that as unfair.
Yeah. Okay. And I agree with you. I think that's kind of actually the almost hypocritical response, really, by these Cruz delegates. You remember, he got a lot of his delegates by following the rules and doing these, you know, what a lot of people perceived as insider tricks. And then when it came time to follow the rules, suddenly they didn't want to do that. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Cruz speech. And then, so buckle up for that. And welcome back. We're talking about the RNC convention that wrapped up in Cleveland. To do that, we're talking with Brendan Kirby. He's a senior political reporter for LifeSet.com. And so we're in, here it is Wednesday night. Cruz is about ready to step out and do his speech. From your discussions on the delegates and also your own experience, what was the expectations there?
The expectations for what Cruz is going to say?
Yeah. Was there a mood in the room?
Obviously, there was a lot of anticipation about whether he was going to endorse Trump or not. I think that was what was first and foremost on everybody's minds. And it was kind of funny when this was happening, from my perspective. You know, if you are watching a sporting event live, and this is held at this convention in a sports arena, so it's kind of an analogous situation. But you know, if you're at a sporting event and you're sort of far from the action, and something happens and you can't quite tell what's going on, and you figure, you know, you maybe would have had a better seat in your living room watching it on TV. And that's sort of how I felt with the Cruz speech, because I was sort of only half listening to it because I was preparing for the Mike Pence speech, which was what was going to be the main focus of our coverage. And then, there's this commotion going on. And that's when, you know, Trump walked onto the floor, and then they escorted Heidi Cruz out of the arena. And you know, and I sort of missed what was going on with that, and then was able to kind of catch up later and see what was going on. But that's a classic situation of, you probably had a better view of that watching on television, than I did in the arena. And it was very interesting too. I don't know if you saw Newt Gingrich, who was the very next speaker after
that.
He tried to clean it up by saying, I think you all misunderstood what Senator Cruz was saying. He was saying that you should vote your conscience, but for the conscience voter, there is really only one choice. It's Donald Trump. So, I think he gave it the best college try to try and clean it up. But that's just, it's another, unscripted development that this convention has kind of been known for. But then again, the flip side of that is, it gets it more on the news. And, I think it probably helps Trump in the end, because I think it sort of helped unify support behind him.
Yes.
You know, people saw that as sort of a bridge too far. And I think people thought that, Donald Trump won this thing fair and square. We need to support him. So for whatever maybe holdout feelings there might have been, I think maybe that might have had the opposite effect of maybe what Senator Cruz was intending.
Very interesting. So if you had to put it percentage-wise, just, you know, from people on the floor and people that you, that, that you would talk to throughout the week, what would you say the shift was? I mean, was there a lot of pro-Cruz people that, you know, by the end of the week, they were now supporting Trump?
Yeah, I think so. I think most of the delegates, even the ones that, you know, who Donald Trump was not their first choice, and even some of the ones who were on board for this last-ditch effort, when the choice is Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, I don't think any of the delegates are going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Huh. And you might get a few delegates that say they're not going to vote or cast some sort of protest vote, but I don't think Donald Trump's problem in the electorate is going to be with Republican delegates. They were pretty unified, and he got a pretty strong response from the floor during his speech. So, I think the Never Trump movement is over from that standpoint. And then the question is going to be, you know, how well can Donald Trump do among non-Republicans? Can he get a larger share of independents? Can he really dig into these Bernie Sanders supporters? But I don't think he's really going to have to worry about rank and file Republicans. Certainly not the Republican activists that were on the floor.
Yeah, I was listening to the news there the day after the convention, and I think it was Newt that said it best, is that I don't know necessarily that everybody's unified here coming out of the RNC convention, but I think everybody will be unified after the Democrat convention. So I thought that pretty much nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times the best motivator is what the other side does.
Yes.
And really for Trump and Hillary, a big part of both of their appeals is that they're not the other one.
Yeah.
because they both have these high negative ratings. So we'll see who can overcome their negative ratings the best. But yeah, I saw a guy on the floor who was holding up a sign. He said Cruz delegates for Trump. So
yeah. Well, interesting. It'll be interesting next week for sure. I mean, coming out of the convention, Trump is the law and order candidate. And so what's Hillary's response going to be? Oh no, I'm not for that. But just real quick, I've got about a minute and a half here in this segment. The Trump family, I mean, they just were on display. I thought they are his secret weapon. I mean, they did such a great job of promoting not only their dad, but also letting people see a side of Trump that maybe they haven't seen before because of so much negative press about him.
Yeah, I think every one of the Trump kids nailed it, really. I thought they all gave really good speeches. The first one up on the roster was Donald Trump Jr.
Oh, awesome.
I thought his speech was very good.
Yeah.
I thought Eric was pretty good. I mean, and even Tiffany Trump, who is sort of the lesser-known Trump child, she hasn't been as prominent in the campaign. She's younger. And I thought she gave a pretty good speech, considering it was sort of the first time that a lot of people saw her and knew her. I mean, you know, I was thinking maybe they should run Barron up there, the child Trump, and let him speak too. And, you know, Ivanka's speech went over very well with the delegates. They seemed to really like her. So, yeah, I think all the Trump kids exceeded expectations.
Well, and Melania, I thought, did such an outstanding job. It's it's the liberal media, and they're going to do whatever they can to attack her. But, I mean, this whole notion that she plagiarized some of Michelle Obama's speech, does that have any legs going forward?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think the speech itself was good, and she came off as a warm and loving wife.
Yes.
And she's sort of an enigma to people, I think, because she's been sort of shy and reluctant about being out there front and center, and we haven't really heard her speak much. So I thought she did a fine job on that.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the plagiarism, the negative for Trump was that it dominated the storyline when it would have been better served to be talking about something else. But I don't think there's a single person who's inclined to vote for Trump who's going to say, well, that's it, I'm not going to vote for Trump now because of Melania's speech. I just don't see that happening.
No, I don't see that either. And plus, she is living proof that legal immigration works. All right, stay with us. We're going to be wrapping things up with Brendan Kirby. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show, talking about the RNC convention with Brendan Kirby, a senior political reporter for LifeZet.com. And so Brendan, in the 4.5 minutes here that we have, talk to us a little bit about that speech last night from Trump. I thought that was an amazing speech. But what was it like there in the room? Because it to us at home, it looked absolutely crazy. People were ecstatic.
Well, it really was. And it was a big contrast with the rest of the convention. You know, Donald Trump famously cited Jeb Bush for being low energy, and his convention at times has kind of been low energy. The New York Times kind of snickered that there were empty seats in the arena for some of the early days. There were no empty seats last night, and the delegate floor, it was shoulder-to-shoulder people, and the seats were all packed, and it was pretty raucous. And I thought the first half of the speech especially, it was very strong, and the people responded very well to it. I think it's probably the best teleprompter speech that Trump has ever delivered, at least ones that I've seen. I did think maybe it went on a little too long. It was an hour and a quarter. It's the longest acceptance speech in decades. And I think after about 45 minutes or so, people start getting antsy. So I wonder if he sort of lost people toward the end. But you know, the first half of that speech, and especially right in the middle of the prime time era hour, I think he did very well.
I did too. And there was a moment, probably I'd say about two thirds of the way through, that I thought, wow, this is starting to get a little long. And so I got a little distracted with my own thinking on that. But then once I started to relax again and not really think about that, the rest of the speech just flowed. I was very impressed by that. And one of the things that was really interesting to me is that in his speech, he never once addressed Cruz's speech, nor any of the dissenters or the diehard Never Trump people. But it was, you know, getting back to our earlier thoughts, is I really thought it was masterful on Trump's part to let Cruz say what he did, because it set up such a strong contrast. But to me, the kind of the sad point about that is that Trump came out and gave an exceptionally pro-American speech, and it's sad to think that Cruz people just can't bring themselves to get behind that.
Yeah, it was obviously a very tough campaign. I think Trump absolutely made the right call to not address that at all.
And, yeah, and that, I agree.
You know, he tends to sometimes get dragged into these side issues, and I think it hurts him. And I think it would have been disastrous if he had tried to engage that last night.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was very good. There were two ads. He mainly stuck to the script. But one, you know, people were chanting, you know, lock her up, lock her up.
Yes.
And the convention has come under criticism for that. And he very deftly just kind of looked at the crowd and said, let's defeat her in November. I thought
yes.
That was a very strong ad-lib. And then the other one was he delivered prepared remarks about doing everything that he could to protect the LGBT community, you know, from terrorism and just in general. And people cheered. And this was an ad-lib, wasn't in the speech. He said, as a Republican, I just want to say how happy I am that you all cheered that. And I thought that was a very interesting kind of counter-narrative to the stereotype that, you know, Republicans are bigoted gay bashers. And, you know, I don't know how much attention that got from the mainstream media, but I thought it was a pretty telling ad-lib line.
Yeah, well, and I thought, too, that it's interesting that it gets back to this notion that the press just doesn't know what to do with him, because he's out there saying things that just aren't expected. He's certainly changing the face of the Republican Party, and it's just they're out of their league. But I think really where he really nailed it was when he said that the legacy of Hillary Clinton is death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness, and contrast that with his own vision of making America great again.
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of really strong lines in there. Stephen Miller, who was an aide to Jeff Sessions, I actually knew him back from my newspaper days in Alabama. He jumped to the Trump campaign a few months ago, and he was largely responsible for writing that speech. And I thought he did a really good job. The lines were good. It was like I said, it maybe was a little too long, but that was a very well crafted speech. And then, I mean, Trump just his delivery. I mean, you can have great written words, and if it's not well delivered, it falls flat.
That's right.
He delivered it strongly.
Yeah, I thought he was exceptional, and I thought anybody that doubted that he was presidential saw that is just simply not true. I thought it was a very presidential speech. Brendan, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here. I want to thank you so much for your time, and good luck recovering this week, although we now have the Democrats to face.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'll try to get some sleep before Monday.
There you go. All right, thanks again. That is all our time for today, although just a quick reminder that Kamal Saleem will be with us again next week for the second half of his show. And don't forget, Rally Around the Flag event is coming up next Saturday, July 30th in Cottage Grove. Head to iSpyRadio.com and check out the events page. If you're out of the area but know someone in the area, let them know so they can attend. While you're there, check out my latest article that was featured on LifeSet, which we mentioned earlier in the show. You can find that by heading to the blog page there on iSpyRadio.com. And that article was also picked up on Real Clear Politics, so that's pretty cool. But as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a faith
that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.